Tonight, we are very pleased to present Richard Yates. He is the author of the novels Revolutionary Road, Disturbing the Peace, The Easter Parade, and A Special Providence. He has been acclaimed for all of these, but as a lone, uncertified reader and critic, I was especially stirred by The Easter Parade. He has received many accolades for his brilliant new novel, A Good School, a novel about a mediocre New England preparatory school that nevertheless manages in the World War II period to help a young boy pass from uncertain adolescence to a fairly stable type of maturity. This evening he will be reading a short story from his volume, 11 Kinds of Loneliness. I would like to present to you now Richard Yates.
Thank you. This is going to take about a half an hour. I think it's a pretty good idea to announce that first, so you won't be studying your watches towards the end. And maybe you'll be studying your watches anyway, but I hope not. It's an old story. I wrote it in 1952, which, as anybody knows, is a long time ago. So what you're getting tonight is an antique. I think everybody knows that nothing has changed more. There have been no more significant social changes in our society over the past 20 or 30 years than in the relations between men and women. That's what this story is about. And because it goes back a good way, it may have the interest that an antique does. You have to keep in mind, in other words, that this is set in 1952. The story is called The Best of Everything. Nobody expected Grace to do any work the Friday before her wedding. In fact, nobody would let her, whether she wanted to or not. A gardenia corsage lay in a cellophane box beside her typewriter from Mr. Atwood, her boss, and tucked inside the envelope that came with it was a $10 gift certificate from Bloomingdale's. Mr. Atwood had treated her with a special shy courtliness ever since the time she necked with him at the office Christmas party. And now when she went in to thank him, he was all hunched over, rattling desk drawers, blushing and grinning and barely meeting her eyes. "Aw, now don't mention it, Grace," he said. "Pleasure's all mine. Here, you need a pin to put that gadget on with?" "There's a pin that came with it," she said, holding up the corsage. "See, a nice white one." Beaming, he watched her pin the flowers high on the lapel of her suit. Then he cleared his throat importantly and pulled out the writing panel of his desk, ready to give the morning's dictation. But it turned out there were only two short letters, and it wasn't until an hour later when she caught him handing over a pile of dictaphone cylinders to central typing that she realized he had done her a favor. "That's very sweet of you, Mr. Atwood," she said, "but I do think you ought to give me all your work today, just like any other." "Oh, now, Grace," he said, "you only get married once." The girls all made a fuss over her too, crowding around her desk and giggling, asking again and again to see Ralph's photograph. "Oh, he's cute." While the office manager looked on nervously, reluctant to be a spoilsport, but anxious to point out that it was, after all, a working day. Then at lunch, there was the traditional little party at Schrapp's. 9 women and girls, giddy on their unfamiliar cocktails, letting their chicken a la king grow cold while they pummeled her with old times and good wishes. There were more flowers and another gift, a silver candy dish for which all the girls had whisperingly chipped in. Grace said, "Thank you, and I certainly do appreciate it, and I don't know what to say," until her head rang with the words and the corners of her mouth ached from smiling, and she thought the afternoon would never end. Ralph called up about 4 o'clock, exuberant. "How you doing, honey?" he asked, and before she could answer, he said, "Listen, guess what I got?" "I don't know. A present or something?" "What?" She tried to sound excited, but it wasn't easy. "A bonus, $50. She could almost see the flattening of his lips as he said, $50, with the particular earnestness he reserved for pronouncing sums of money. "Why, that's lovely, Ralph," she said, and if there was any tiredness in her voice, he didn't notice it. "Lovely, huh?" he said with a laugh, mocking the girlishness of the word. "You like that, huh, Gracie?" "No, but I mean, I was really surprised. You know what? The boss says, 'Here, Ralph.' And he hands me this envelope. He don't even crack a smile or nothing, and I'm wondering, what's the deal here? I'm getting fired here or what?" He says, "Go ahead, Ralph, open it." So I open it, and then I look at the boss, and he's grinning a mile wide. He chuckled and sighed. "Well, so listen, honey. What time do you want me to come over tonight?" "Oh, I don't know. Soon as you can, I guess." "Well, listen, I got to go over at Eddie's house and pick up that bag he's going to loan me. So I might as well do that, go on home and eat, and then come over to your place around 8:30, 9 o'clock. Okay?" "All right," she said. "I'll see you then, darling." She had been calling him darling for only a short time, since it had become irrevocably clear that she was, after all, going to marry him, and the word still had an alien sound. As she straightened the stacks of stationery in her desk, because there was nothing else to do, a familiar little panic gripped her. She couldn't marry him. She hardly even knew him. Sometimes it occurred to her differently, that she couldn't marry him because she knew him too well. And either way, it left her badly shaken, vulnerable to all the things that Martha, her roommate, had said from the beginning. "Isn't he funny?" Martha said after their first date. "He says, 'Turlet.' I didn't know people really said, 'Turlet.'" And Grace had giggled, ready enough to agree that it was funny. That was a time when she had been ready to agree with Martha on practically anything. When it often seemed, in fact, that finding a girl like Martha from an advertisement in the New York Times was just about the luckiest thing that had ever happened to her. But Ralph had persisted all through the summer, and by fall she'd begun standing up for him. "What don't you like about him, Martha?" "He's perfectly nice." "Oh, everybody's perfectly nice, Grace," Martha would say in her college voice, making perfectly nice a faintly absurd thing to be. And then she'd look up crossly from the careful painting of her fingernails. "It's just that he's such a little white worm. Can't you see that?" "Well, I certainly don't see what his complexion has to do with." "Oh, God, you know what I mean. Can't you see what I mean? Oh, and all those friends of his Eddie and his Marty and his George, with their mean, ratty little clerks' lives and their mean, ratty little... It's just that they're all alike, those people. All they ever say is, 'Hey, what happened to you Giants?' And, 'Hey, what happened to you Yankees?' And they all live way out in Sunnyside or Woodhaven or some awful place. And their mothers have those damn little china elephants on the mantelpiece." And Martha would frown over her nail polish again, making it clear that the subject was closed. All that fall and winter, she was confused. For a while, she tried going out only with Martha's kind of men, the kind that used words like amusing all the time and wore small-shouldered flannel suits like a uniform. And for a while, she tried going out with no man at all. She even tried that crazy business with Mr. Atwood at the office Christmas party. And all the time, Ralph kept calling up, hanging around, waiting for her to make up her mind. Once she took him home to meet her parents in Pennsylvania, where she never would have dreamed of taking Martha. But it wasn't until Easter time that she finally gave in. They had gone to a dance somewhere in Queens, one of the big American Legion dances that Ralph's crowd was always going to. And when the band played Easter Parade, he held her very close, hardly moving, and sang to her in a faint, whispering tenor. It was the kind of thing she'd never have expected Ralph to do, a sweet, gentle thing. And it probably wasn't just then that she decided to marry him, but it always seemed so afterwards. It always seemed she had decided that minute, swaying to the music with his husky voice in her hair. I'll be all in clover, and when they look you over, I'll be the proudest fella in the Easter Parade. That night she had told Martha, and she could still see the look on Martha's face. Oh, Grace, you're not, surely you're not serious. I mean, I thought he was more or less of a joke. You can't mean you really want to. Shut up. You just shut up, Martha. And she'd cried all night. Even now, she hated Martha for it. Even if she, as she stared blindly over a row of filing cabinets along the office wall, half sick with fear that Martha was right. The noise of giggles swept over her, and she saw with a start that two of the girls, Irene and Rose, were grinning over their typewriters and pointing at her. We saw you, Irene sang. We saw you mooning again, huh, Grace? Then Rose did a little burlesque of mooning, heaving her meager breasts and batting her eyes, and they both collapsed in laughter. With an effort of will, Grace resumed the guileless, open smile of a bride. The thing to do was concentrate on plans. Tomorrow morning, bright and early, as her mother would say, she would meet Ralph at Penn Station for the trip home. They'd arrive about 1, and her parents would meet the train. Good to see you, Ralph, her father would say, and her mother would probably kiss him. A warm, homely love filled her. They wouldn't call him a white worm. They didn't have any ideas about Princeton men and interesting men and all the other kinds of men Martha was so stuck up about. Then her father would probably take Ralph out for a beer and show him the paper mill where he worked. And at least Ralph wouldn't be snobby about a person working in a paper mill either. And then Ralph's family and friends would come down from New York in the evening. She'd have time for a long talk with her mother that night and the next morning, bright and early. Her eyes stung at the thought of her mother's plain, happy face. They would start getting dressed for the wedding, then the church and the ceremony, and then the reception. Would her father get drunk? Would Muriel Ketchell sulk about not being a bridesmaid? And finally, the train to Atlantic City and the hotel. But from the hotel on, she couldn't plan anymore. A door would lock behind her, and there would be a wild, fantastic silence, and nobody else in all the world but Ralph to lead the way. Well, Grace, Mr. Atwood was saying, I want to wish you every happiness. He was standing at her desk with his hat and coat on, and all around her were the chattering and scraping back of chairs. That meant it was 5 o'clock. Thank you, Mr. Atwood. She got to her feet, suddenly surrounded by all the girls and a bedlam of farewell. All the luck in the world, Grace. Drop us a card, huh, Grace, from the Atlantic City? So long, Grace. Good night, Grace, and listen, the best of everything. Finally, she was free of them all, out of the elevator, out of the building, hurrying through the crowds to the subway. When she got home, Martha was standing in the door of the kitchenette, looking very svelte in a crisp new dress. Hi, Grace. I bet they ate you alive today, didn't they? Oh, no, Grace said. Everybody was real nice. She sat down exhausted and dropped the flowers and the wrapped candy dish on the table. Then she noticed that the whole apartment was swept and dusted and the dinner was cooking in the kitchenette. Gee, everything looks wonderful, she said. What'd you do all this for? Oh, well, I got home early anyway, Martha said. Then she smiled, and it was one of the few times Grace had ever seen her look shy. I just thought it might be nice to have the place looking decent for a change when Ralph comes over. Well, Grace said, it certainly was nice of you. The way Martha looked now was even more surprising. She looked awkward. She was turning a greasy spatula in her fingers, holding it delicately away from her dress and examining it as if she had something difficult to say. Look, Grace, she began. You do understand why I can't come to the wedding, don't you? Oh, sure, Grace said, although in fact she didn't exactly. It was something about having to go up to Harvard to see her brother before he went into the army, but it had sounded like a lie from the beginning. It's just that I'd hate you to think I'd... Well, anyway, I'm glad if you do understand. And the other thing I wanted to say is more important. What? Well, just that I'm sorry for all the awful things I used to say about Ralph. I never had a right to talk to you that way. He's a very sweet boy, and I... Well, I'm sorry, that's all. It wasn't easy for Grace to hide a rush of gratitude and relief when she said, Why, that's all right, Martha. The chops are on fire. Martha bolted to the kitchenette. It's all right, she called back. They're edible. And when she came out to serve dinner, all her old composure was restored. I'll have to eat and run, she said. My train leaves in 40 minutes. I thought it was tomorrow you were going. Well, it was, actually, Martha said. But I decided to go tonight because another thing. You see, Grace, another thing is that I've hardly ever given you a chance to be alone. I'm sorry, I screwed that up. Let me go over it again. Because you see, another thing, Grace, if you can stand one more apology, another thing I'm sorry for is that I've hardly ever given you and Ralph a chance to be alone here. So tonight I'm going to clear out. She hesitated. It'll be a sort of wedding gift from me, okay? And then she smiled, not shyly this time, but in a way that was more in character. The eyes subtly averted after a flicker of special meaning. It was a smile that Grace, through stages of suspicion, bewilderment, awe, and practiced imitation, had long ago come to associate with the word sophisticated. Excuse me. Well, that's very sweet of you, Grace said. But she didn't really get the point just then. It wasn't until long after the meal was over and the dishes washed, until Martha had left for her train in a whirl of cosmetics and luggage and quick goodbyes, that she began to understand. She took a deep, voluptuous bath and spent a long time drying herself, posing in the mirror, filled with a strange, slow excitement. In her bedroom, from the rustling tissues of an expensive white box, she drew the prizes of her trousseau, a sheer nightgown of white nylon and a matching negligee, put them on, and went to the mirror again. She had never worn anything like this before, or felt like this, and the thought of letting Ralph see her like this sent her into the kitchenette for a glass of the special dry sherry Martha kept for cocktail parties. Then she turned out all the lights but one and, carrying her glass, went to the sofa and arranged herself there to wait for him. After a while, she got up and brought the sherry bottle over to the coffee table, where she set it on a tray with another glass. When Ralph left the office, he felt vaguely let down. Somehow, he'd expected more of the Friday before his wedding. The bonus check had been all right, though secretly he'd been counting her twice that amount. And the boys had bought him a drink at lunch and kidded around in the appropriate way. I don't feel too bad, Ralph. Worse things could happen. But still, there ought to have been a real party. Not just the boys in the office, but Eddie and all his friends. Instead, they would only be meeting Eddie at White Rose, like every other night of the year, and then riding home to borrow Eddie's suitcase and to eat, and having to ride all the way back into Manhattan just to see Gracie for an hour or two. Eddie wasn't in the bar when he arrived, which sharpened the edge of his loneliness. Morosely, he drank a beer, waiting. Eddie was his best friend, and an ideal best man, because he'd been in on the courtship of Gracie from the start. It was in this very bar, in fact, that Ralph had told him about their first date last summer. Ooh, Eddie, what a pair of knockers. And Eddie had grinned. Yeah? So what's the roommate like? Ah, you don't want the roommate, Eddie. The roommate's a dog. A snob, too, I think. No, but this other one, this little Gracie. Boy, I mean, she is stacked. Half the fun of every date, even more than half, had been telling Eddie about it afterwards, exaggerating a little here and there, asking Eddie's advice on tactics. But after today, like so many other pleasures, it would all be left behind. Gracie had promised him at least one night a week to spend with the boys after they were married. But even so, it would never be the same. Girls never understood a thing like friendship. There was a ball game on the bar's television screen, and he watched it idly, his throat swelling in a sentimental pain of loss. Nearly all his life had been devoted to the friendship of boys and men, to trying to be a good guy, and now the best of it was over. Finally, Eddie's stiff finger jabbed the seat of his pants in greeting. What do you say, sport? Ralph narrowed his eyes to indolent contempt and slowly turned around. What happened to you, wise guy? Get lost? What are you, in a hurry or something? Eddie barely moved his lips when he spoke. Can't wait 2 minutes? He slouched on a stool and slid a quarter at the bartender. Draw one there, Jack. They drank in silence for a while, staring at the television. Got a little bonus today, Ralph said. $50. Yeah, Eddie said. Good. A batter struck out. The inning was over and the commercial came on. So, Eddie said, rocking the beer around in his glass, still gonna get married? Why not? Ralph said with a shrug. Listen, finish that, will you? I'm gonna get a move on. Wait a while. What's your hurry? Come on, will you? Ralph stepped impatiently away from the bar. I want to go pick up your bag. Ah, bag schmag. Ralph moved up close again and glowered at him. Look, wise guy. Nobody's going to make you loan me the goddamn bag, you know. I don't want to break your heart or nothing. All right. You'll get your bag. Don't worry so much. He finished his beer and wiped his mouth. Let's go. Having to borrow a bag for his wedding trip was a sore point with Ralph. He'd much rather have bought one of his own. There was a fine one displayed in the window of a luggage shop they passed every night on their way to the subway, a big, tawny Gladstone with a zippered compartment on the side, and Ralph had had his eye on it ever since Easter time. Think I'll buy that, he's told Eddie, in the same offhand way that a day or two before he had announced his engagement. Think I'll marry the girl. Eddie's response to both remarks had been the same. What are you, crazy? Both times, Ralph had said, why not? And in defense of the bag, he had added, gonna get married, I'll need something like that. From then on, it was as if the bag, almost as much as Gracie herself, had become the symbol of the new and richer life he sought. But after the ring and the new clothes and all the other expenses, he'd found at last that he couldn't afford it. He had settled for the loan of Eddie's, which was similar but cheaper and worn and without the zippered compartment. Now, as they passed the luggage shop, he stopped, caught in the grip of a reckless idea. Hey, wait a while, Eddie. Know what I think I'll do with that $50 bonus? I think I'll buy that bag right now. He felt breathless. What, are you crazy? $40 for a bag you'll use maybe one time a year? You're crazy, Ralph. Come on. I don't know. You think so? Listen, you better keep your money, boy. You're gonna need it. Yeah. Ralph said at last, I guess you're right. And he fell in step with Eddie again, heading for the subway. This was the way things usually turned out in his life. He could never have a bag, he could never own a bag like that until he made a better salary. And he accepted it, just as he'd accepted without question after the first thin sigh, the knowledge that he would never possess his bride until after the wedding. The subway swallowed them, rattled and banged them along in a rocking, mindless trance for a half an hour, and disgorged them at last into the cool early evening of Queens. Removing their coats and loosening their ties, they let the breeze dry their sweated shirts as they walked. So what's the deal, Eddie asked. What time are we supposed to show up in this Pennsylvania burg tomorrow? Ah, suit yourself, Ralph said. Any time in the evening's okay. So what do we do then? What the hell can you do in a hillbilly town like that anyway? I don't know, Ralph said defensively. Sit around and talk, I guess. Drink beer with Gracie's old man or something, I don't know. Jesus, Eddie said, some weekend. Big deal. Ralph stopped on the sidewalk, suddenly enraged, his damp coat wadded in his fist. Look, you bastard. Nobody's gonna make you come, you know. You or Marty or George or any of the rest of them, get that straight. You're not doing me no favors, understand? What's the matter? Eddie inquired. What's the matter? Can't you take a joke? Joke, Ralph said. You're full of jokes. And plodding sullenly in Eddie's wake, he felt close to tears. They turned off into the block where they both lived, a double row of neat, identical houses bordering the street where they'd fought and loafed and played stickball all their lives. Eddie pushed open the front door of his house and ushered Ralph into the vestibule with his homely smell of cauliflower and overshoes. Go on in, he said, jerking a thumb at the closed living room door. Then he hung back to let Ralph go first. Ralph opened the door and took three steps inside before it hit him like a sock on the jaw. The room, dead silent, was packed deep with grinning, red-faced men. Marty, George, the boys from the office, the boys from the block. Everybody, all his friends, all on their feet and poised motionless in a solid mass. Skinny McGuire was crouched at the upright piano, his spread fingers high over the keys, and when he struck the first rollicking chords, they all roared into song, beating time with their fists, their enormous grins distorting the words. For he's a jolly good fella, for he's a jolly good fella, for he's a jolly good fella that nobody can deny. Weakly, Ralph retreated a step on the carpet and stood there wide-eyed, swallowing, holding his coat. That nobody can deny, they sang, that nobody can deny. And as they swung into the second chorus, Eddie's father appeared through the dining room curtains, bald and beaming, in full song, with a great glass pitcher of beer in either hand. At last, Skinny'd hammered out the final line, that nobody can deny. And they all surged forward, cheering, grabbing Ralph's hand, pounding his arms and his back, while he stood trembling, his own voice lost under the noise. Gee, fellas, thanks, I don't know what to... Thanks, fellas. Then the crowd cleaved in half, and Eddie made his way slowly down the middle. His eyes gleamed in a smile of love, and from his bashful hand hung the suitcase. Not his own, but a new one. The big, tawny Gladstone with the zippered compartment on the side. Speech, they were yelling. Speech, speech. But Ralph couldn't speak and couldn't smile. He could hardly even see. At 10 o'clock, Grace began walking around the apartment and biting her lip. What if he wasn't coming? But of course he was coming. She sat down and carefully smoothed the billows of nylon around her thighs, forcing herself to be calm. The whole thing would be ruined if she was nervous. The noise of the doorbell was like an electric shock. She was halfway to the door before she stopped, breathing hard, and composed herself again. Then she pressed the buzzer and opened the door a crack to watch for him on the stairs. When she saw he was carrying a suitcase and saw the pale seriousness of his face as he mounted the stairs, she thought at first that he knew. He had come prepared to lock the door and take her in his arms. Hello, darling, she said softly and opened the door wider. Hi, baby. He brushed past her and walked inside. Guess I'm late, huh? You in bed? No. She closed the door and leaned against it with both hands holding the doorknob at the small of her back, the way heroines close doors in the movies. I was just waiting for you. He wasn't looking at her. He went to the sofa and sat down, holding the suitcase on his lap and running his fingers over it. Gracie, he said, barely above a whisper, look at this. She looked at it and then into his tragic eyes. Remember, he said, I told you about that bag I wanted to buy, $40. He stopped and looked around. Hey, where's Martha? She in bed? She's gone, darling, Grace said, moving slowly to the sofa. She's gone for the whole weekend. She sat down beside him, leaned close, and gave him Martha's special smile. Oh, yeah? He said. Well, anyway, listen. I was going to borrow Eddie's bag instead, remember? Yes. Well, so the night at the White Rose, I says, come on, Eddie, let's go and pick up your bag. He says, ah, bag, schmag. I says, what's the matter? But he don't say nothing, see? So we go home to his place, and the living room door's shut, see? She squirmed closer and put her head on his chest. Automatically, he raised his arm, raised an arm, and dropped it around her shoulders, still talking. He says, go ahead, Ralph, open the door. I says, what's the deal? He says, never mind, Ralph, open the door. So I opened the door, and oh, Jesus. His fingers gripped her shoulder with such intensity that she looked up at him in alarm. They was all there, Gracie, he said. All the fellas, playing the piano, singing, cheering. His voice wavered and his eyelids fluttered shut, their lashes wet. A big surprise party, he said, trying to smile. For me, can you beat that, Gracie? And then Eddie comes out and gives me this, the very same bag I've been looking at all this time. He bought it with his own money, and he didn't say nothing, just to give me a surprise. Here, Ralph, he says, just to let you know you're the greatest guy in the world. His fingers tightened again, trembling. I cried, Gracie, he whispered. I couldn't help it. I don't think the fella saw it or anything, but I was crying. He turned his face away and worked his lips in a tremendous effort to hold back the tears. "Would you like a drink, darling?" she asked gently. "Nah, that's all right. Gracie, I'm all right." He set the suitcase on the carpet. "Only give me a cigarette, huh?" She got one from the coffee table, put it in his lips and lighted it. "Let me get you a drink," she said. He frowned through the smoke. "What do you got, that sherry wine?" "No, I don't like that stuff. Anyway, I'm full of beer." He leaned back and closed his eyes. "And then Eddie's mother feeds us this terrific meal," he went on, and his voice was almost normal now. "We had steaks. We had French fried potatoes." His head rolled on the sofa back with each item of the menu. "Lettuce and tomato salad, pickles, bread, butter, everything. The works." "Well," she said, "wasn't that nice?" "And afterwards we had ice cream and coffee," he said, "and all the beer we could drink. I mean, it was a real spread." Grace ran her hands over her lap, partly to smooth the nylon and partly to dry the moisture on her palms. "Well, that certainly was nice of them," she said. And they sat there for what seemed a long time. "I can only stay a minute, Gracie," Ralph said. "I promise him I'd be back." Her heart thumped under the nylon. "Ralph, do you like this?" "What, honey?" "My negligee. You weren't supposed to see it until after the wedding, but I thought I'd..." "Nice?" he said, feeling the flimsy material between thumb and index finger like a merchant. "Very nice. What'd you pay for this, honey?" "Oh, I don't know, but did you like it?" He kissed her and began at last to stroke her with his hands. "Nice," he kept saying. "Nice. Hey, I like this." His hand hesitated at the low neckline, slipped inside, and held her breast. "I do love you, Ralph," she whispered. "You know that, don't you?" His fingers pinched her nipple once and slid quickly out again. The policy of restraint, the habit of months, was too strong to break. "Sure," he said, "and I love you, baby. Now you be a good girl and get your beauty sleep, and I'll see you in the morning, okay?" "Oh, Ralph, don't go. Stay." "I promised the fellas, Gracie." He stood up and straightened his clothes. "They're waiting for me out home." She blazed to her feet, but the cry that was meant for a woman's appeal came out through her tightening lips as the whine of a wife. "Can't they wait?" "What are you, crazy?" He backed away, eyes round with righteousness. She would have to understand. If this was the way she acted before the wedding, how the hell was it going to be afterwards? "Have a heart, will you, Gracie? Keep the fellas waiting tonight after all they've done for me." After a second or two, during which her face became less pretty than he had ever seen it before, she was able to smile. "Of course not, darling. You're right." He came forward again and gently brushed the tip of her chin with his fist, smiling, a husband reassured. "That's more like it," he said. "So I'll see you at Penn Station, 9 o'clock tomorrow. Right, Gracie? Only before I go," he winked and slapped his belly, "I'm full of beer. Mind if I use your toilet?" When he came out of the bathroom, she was waiting to say goodnight, standing with her arms folded across her chest as if for warmth. Lovingly, he hefted the new suitcase and joined her at the door. "Okay then, baby," he said and kissed her. 9 o'clock. Don't forget now." She smiled tiredly and opened the door for him. "Don't worry, Ralph," she said. "I'll be there. Thank you."
Do you mind answering questions,
Sure.
I would like to thank Mr. Yeats very much for his very effective reading of his fine short story. He has indicated that he would be willing to answer any questions you might have. Are there any questions or comments? Oh, no, they're not bored, no. No, I think they're just absorbing your short story, that's all.